welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is October 25th, 2024, and this is episode 479. You're listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warner. And by the way, I think starting next month, because of Apple's, you know, 19th century railroad monopoly policy, folks, if you want to subscribe to Radio Warner, you're going to have to do it, I guess, through, well, you won't be able to do it through your iPhone app. You can do it through, you know, the web or through your Android or whatever else the kids use, but we're boycotting the Apple Trust. So you won't be able to subscribe starting, I guess, November 1st through the Patreon app on Apple iPhones. Anyway, my name is Mark Ames. I'm the co-host of Radio Warner here in Western New York. I am on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. the Warner, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in the South Island of New Zealand. How's it going, John?
It's going kind of interestingly. I'm in Dunedin alone because Catherine has gone north to Queenstown for the memorial service for her brother, Sean, who died a few weeks ago. And it's, you know, I don't believe in haunted places very much, but it was probably just being alone after not being alone for a long time. But I suddenly was very alert last night. And then I noticed what I thought was a female voice making a little cry. And I thought, oh, come on. At this age, I'm going to run into a real haunting. No, it's too late for that. And then I realized, no, that's the noise my throat makes. Because the reason I didn't go up for the memorial service is that I have some kind of chest asthma symptoms. And one of them is that I breathe in a soprano voice. So that was a relief.
Mm. So, or it could be a poltergeist in one of your lungs. Speaking of lungs, I think I told you, I have pneumonia. So this is Radio Pneumonia Nerd. I'm the fourth one to go down with pneumonia, the last one to go down. I held out as long as I could, Sergeant, but I couldn't do it anymore. And probably one thing that helped it is I promised to help my older son, Sammy, get into better shape in this jock hick school we're in. And it's become kind of important to him. So I took him out for a jog with pneumonia. And let me tell you, don't jog with pneumonia in October. That did not do it well. It's funny. The doctor sort of thought, well, he did the stethoscope test. And he said, your breathing sounds great, but we'll do the chest x-ray just in case since it's going around. And sure enough, in the left lung, it was, when you read the report, it says it's something about collapsed part of the lower left lung, but it's really just fluid in the lung, I guess.
Right.
And this is a really, I got to say, my wife is convinced, and I kind of am too, that this is some new COVID hybrid or something. I guess any virus could kind of mutate, but this hasn't really felt like anything I'd had before, and there are some strange symptoms. I mean, I tested for COVID, it was negative, and my wife did too. But like, this has been a painful as hell cough. Like, as I said, it was like gargling broken glass. And yet, for me at least, not much of anything with the sinus. I had a bit of a fever. I'd get these chills, but it was more like the feeling of getting hit by a truck. But other weird things, like everything tastes bitter. Sweet things taste. I have no appetite because everything tastes bitter. Or certainly things that I would like
COVID.
To eat. Yeah. And a really weird symptom, I often take melatonin to help me stay asleep after I fall asleep. And it just did nothing at all as soon as I got this. And I kind of brought up to my wife, I'm like, this is kind of weird. I started taking NyQuil to help me instead. And she said, oh yeah, melatonin just stopped working the minute I got this. And I told the doctor that, and he said, that's really weird. And he said, we'll just call this COVID pneumonia because it doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
You could be patient X for COVID pneumonia.
Yeah. You can thank me for giving it to you if you get it.
Yeah.
So let's get to our guest. Very excited to have him back. Friend of the show, previous Radio Warner guest, Peter Karatayev, who runs the excellent Events in Ukraine Substack. Peter was with us in episode 450, Ukrainocracy. That was in mid-June, so July, August, September, so 4 months ago. A lot's happened since then. And he also was with us in episode 319, Escape from Kyiv. He was the guy that we talked to who escaped from Kyiv when it was getting bombed by the Russians. And
now it can be revealed.
Yeah. First of all, Peter, welcome back to the show. And again, I want to congratulate you on just how awesome Events in Ukraine is.
Thanks so much for having me back. Thanks a lot as well for the subscribers of Radio Warner that have come along to my Substack as well after coming on your show, which I appreciate.
Oh, good. Glad to.
Some great subscribers you guys have.
Our subscribers.
We love our subscribers, let me tell you, yeah. No, but they're also curious and smart and
the lies are hard to avoid. I mean, so much lying in the Anglo press. So it's a real relief to come to your messages and get some blunt truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, at my web computer, it goes, you know, when you open up the browser, it automatically goes to, I live in Australia at the moment, by the way. The Australian, MSN, CNN News, whatever it is here. And it's always, you know, Putin this, Putin that, Koreans this. So it's kind of refreshing, you know, because I never actually watch that stuff. Right. And it's sort of motivating as well, to keep on writing, you know, just because it's, that whole feeling of dissonance and so on. But,
Yeah, your Events in Ukraine, I may have said this before, but I want to say it again. I mean, the thing, I find it thrilling. I'm a big fan, as I told him, and I find each newsletter, thrilling in a way that it brings me back to the exile days, because there was such a vast chasm between the sanitized Russia, the Russia that was packaged in the kind of Cold War, the really dumb binaries. First, during the Yeltsin years, that everything in Russia was going great. It was turning into suburban Omaha. Just give it a couple more years and get rid of some bad communists, you know, who are still lingering. And then as things actually did start turning up under Putin, it was turning fascist, of course, and bad. But they never, you know, presented Russia as it was. Whereas what we did a lot in the exile, especially in the first few years, when Russia's media environment was so wild and free, is all you really had to do was, you know, report on what the Russians were saying to each other about what was going on in Russia. And that was such a shock to people in the West, such an absolute shock. And it's the same with, you know, in a lot of ways with what you're doing. I mean, you're reporting what Ukrainians report to each other about their lived experiences, they say. And it is a shock because it is so different from the idealized or sanitized Ukraine, the Cold War-ized Ukraine that we get from our media and also from, you know, the so-called, like the English language so-called Ukrainian voices, like the official Ukrainian voices that seed all social media and all the quotes and everything. And they all come from, as you called it, the new nobility class, right? They all pretty much come from that one class of NGO people.
And we're a week away from a U.S. election, and I read the New York Times, and there's something about a tone-deaf, well, purposely deaf elite in the U.S. as well. Like, they keep asking why people don't like their preferred candidates more, but they don't really want to know. They're just expressing anger.
Yeah.
At the refusal of the masses, as they see them, to go along. And it seems like there's something more, well, a blunter version of that happening in Ukraine.
I really enjoy as well the people that follow Israel-Palestine that look at the Israeli press as well. I think that's very, very enlightening. I think, I mean, Ali Abenimo and so on, Electronic Intifada, they do that quite a lot. And I think that's really fantastic. You know, when you look at these societies, militarized societies, they do have to sort of talk about what's going on, at least to their own people.
Right.
You can glean quite a lot of interesting information there. The problem is that, you know, I think lots of journalists have a very self sort of inflated sense of their ability to access the truth when they visit a foreign country, and they say, oh, well, I'm going to talk with this person. And maybe they even know the language. Mm. And they assume, well, you know, I'll talk to them and they'll tell me the truth. But there are so many other factors in the way when someone meets, you know, a foreign, an American journalist in a country that's at war, you know, and you're from that country. Obviously, what you're going to say is going to be very tilted. And obviously, the type of people they talk to and so on, this, you know, new nobility, which is a term not made up by myself, by the way. That is a term made by a Ukrainian politician. Quite a funny one, actually. Alexander Dubinsky, who's currently in jail for his role in the Hunter Biden story. As I understand, he's spending every single second of his time in jail on Telegram, because he puts out, like, I don't know, five, like, huge, like, long reads about this, you know, complicated conspiracy within the office of the president every single day, which I appreciate, you know, but anyway, interesting guy.
Those are fun. So I think what we should do first before, because again, what Peter describes is unvarnished Ukraine as it is, Ukraine society and Ukraine politics, and more specifically, you know, the Ukraine war. And, you know, last couple episodes, we've been talking about the Israel war. And this is Biden, you know, Joe Biden's other great legacy is the Ukraine war. His proudest moment, by the way. Let's just quickly go over what's happening in the war. And I mean, in a word, it's gone from bad to shit. It's recycling in that same sort of direction for month after month this year, really going back to the counteroffense. I mean, really going back to the fall of Bakhmut, so the Battle of Bakhmut, which would be a year and a half ago. It's just been endlessly bad. But I'm going to read to you a headline. This is just from yesterday in Medusa. Now, Medusa is the leading Russian opposition media outlet. I think it's very good. It's, you know, I know its biases, it's liberal, it's anti-Putin, it's pro-Western values, and I think they're very good. And their military analyst, I mean, he talks about every week. It's in Russian. He's very, very fast Russian. It's a little too hard for me, but he's very good. And I'm just going to read you, this is the English version of it, the headline. This is from yesterday. Russia makes key gains on seven fronts as Ukraine suffers its hardest week on the battlefield this year. And this is what I mean. Like, it's been constantly accelerating how badly this has been going. Now, the Kursk incursion, that was what, the beginning of August. So that was going on 3 months now ago. They sort of punched a hole where there was an easier hole to punch and took advantage of Russian hubris or bad intelligence or whatever. But it was never, we said, I think from the beginning, it seemed strategically insane because they're so stretched thin, there was nothing to be gained there, and they were just going to accelerate Russia's advances, which is exactly what's happened. And in the meantime, the Ukrainians have already lost 50% or more of what they took in Kursk. It's turning into a pocket now. So just going over real quickly in some of these fronts here. I mean, the main one, of course, is in Donetsk. But even up in the north, up in the Kharkiv region, closer to the Russian border, this is a battlefront that was static for a year, over a year now. Russians trying to move to the Oskol River and trying to take or retake. They had taken it once, Kupiansk. They actually managed to reach the Oskol River. They've cut off Kupiansk. And, you know, depending on their forces, their force power, they could take Kupiansk maybe soon, maybe this year. Another big battle, Chasiv Yar. Now, this is not very far from Bakhmut. This moved at absolute snail's pace. But in the last month, and definitely in the last week or so, Chasiv Yar is a very important key town in the Donetsk region. It's west of Bakhmut, but it occupies the highest ground covering a large area of Donetsk. It's close to a larger city, Kostyantynivka. And if they take Chasiv Yar and Kostyantynivka, which is right nearby, from Chasiv Yar, because they have the heights, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk are kind of wide open to the Russians, if they have any mobility, which is an if still. Taryetsk, which is one of the last fortress cities that were built up between 2014 and 22, the Russians have punched through there. They already took New York, and they've made their way about halfway through Taryetsk, and they've advanced a lot recently. And the bigger battles are towards Pokrovsk and Kurakhovo, so that's more south in Donetsk. Just recently, they've surrounded another one of these important towns called Selidove. And instead of taking the town, this is what they've been doing lately. They surround it on all sides. And then the Ukrainians have this sort of terrible retreat. This has been happening a lot lately. Like that happened in Ukrainsk. It happened in Vuhledar. It looks like it's going to happen in Hirnik. So Selidove is going to fall. And the other town they're going for is Kurakhovo, which is a very important logistics hub in the south. Like everything is basically just falling one by one. And it seems to me that trying to read it speaks of two things. One is the Ukrainians are very hollowed out. Their defenses get worse and worse as the Russians push more and more west, because for a variety of reasons, they've been terrible at building defenses. They've been late at it. There's corruption. They use private contractors who don't communicate with each other, and so on and so forth. And it also speaks to a level of Russian... it's on the one hand, it's kind of amazing that Russia has maintained an offensive that hasn't... You know, they always talk about offensives culminating. They culminate in 1 month. They culminate in 2 months. This offensive has been slow and steady, and there's no culmination in sight. I mean, as even Medusa, which puts a disclaimer at the top, we're against this war, we're for Ukraine.
Yeah, the disclaimer was interesting.
Yeah.
Medusa has condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine from the very start.
Because reporting bad news is considered treason to a lot of people in the West. So they have to let you know, we're on your side, we're just trying to be objective here. Which is what you taught us to be, objective, even they didn't realize that we lied about that. But anyway, but I think it's hard to kind of make sense. I mean, on the one hand, Russia is maintaining pressure along like a 700-mile front, which is insane, with nothing like the force structure they had, you know, in World War II. But on the other hand, I don't see any signs that Russians, everybody keeps talking about, can have something like a really mobile breakthrough. Like when they have a breakthrough, that means lines move 2 to 3 kilometers in a day, which is a shocker. But we're not talking about giant holes punched through, at least not yet. And I don't foresee that, but I'm not going to predict anything. Ukraine, you know, graveyard of predictions. But anyway, I think I just wanted to set that general scene. I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that, Peter, before we get into what your newsletter and your deep dives into what Russian military people are saying and what Russian society is saying about what's going on. Is there anything you want to add to that picture at all?
Yeah, I recommend also people having a look at the online resource Deep State.
Yeah,
I think Fed people have probably heard of it. It's managed by Ukrainian military people and provides basically a live map of Russian advances on the front line. But lots of the importance of these battles going on right now, I mean, for instance, with Chasiv Yar is the logistical importance in terms of as its location in relation to different highways.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, I mean, that's why Pokrovsk is quite important,
right.
Because it's there's, you can see there's this big highway that goes
yeah.
west that only goes to Pokrovsk. And in particular, and then like for instance with Konstantinovka, like if they take that, there's no more link between Slavyansk-Kramatorsk and Pokrovsk. They get cut
right.
off. And this is when analysts are looking at particularly the aim to get to Pokrovsk and Konstantinovka and so on, and to take Toretsk. It's to cut off the to split in half the Ukrainian. What do you call it? I mean, like military group in the Donbass into north and south.
Right.
To divide it.
Right.
And that's why there's so much pressure being put in particular. I mean, this is because this is not really the south. The south, that's more like, you know, closer to Zaporizhia and so on. Not much has been happening there. Although I have seen some Ukrainian telegrams talking about how they think that they offensive is being prepared in
yes.
the Zaporizhia region in the south. And
to take Velike Novosielke, or is Velike Novosielke in Donetsk also?
No. That well, yeah. I mean, that's kind of that's south of south of Kurakhova, but it's
right.
Velike Novosielke is in the
it's
southernmost part
okay.
of Donetsk, but it's right bordering on the Zaporizhia region,
right?
Or like Dnipropetrovsk region, really. Anyway, but. Yeah, so the idea is to split them in half, and these roads are very important in terms of obviously, I mean, delivering supplies and so on. So that's what I would point out. Oh, and I mean, in terms of the advances, I mean, what's interesting is that so the actual Donetsk region, because I mean, so much of this fighting has been taking place right around the city of Donetsk itself.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, in that area, since it's this huge industrial city, there are a lot more roads, and you can see them, and they're much closer together, which also makes better logistics. But once they moving out, the roads become further and further apart. This is the thing, because it becomes between, you know, Pokrovsk and say Pavlograd, which is already almost Dnipro, which is one of Ukraine's biggest cities. It's just small towns and it's just one highway. Hopefully this sort of makes sense if you're not looking at the map, but it's easier if you have a look at the map as well. But basically what I'm saying is that it's naturally more difficult to move in these areas where there's lots of cities, lots of major cities like Pokrovsk, Kurakhova, all these different cities, and there are lots of roads connecting them. But then
yeah.
after Pokrovsk, there are it's smaller towns essentially,
right.
and flatter terrain as well.
Right.
And then you just have this one highway which is not connected to any others. It's just one heading west.
Right. The
E50. So anyway.
Or the N50.
Yeah. It's the E50. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
But like Pokrovsk is an actual hub with like spokes coming out. So
it goes in different directions.
Yeah.
And that's why taking it, it would split the forces in half. But
right.
but lots of them different Ukrainian military telegrams. They're talking about how really it's they're focusing more on Selidova and Kurakhova, which are a little bit to the south of Pokrovsk, and they're both fairly close together, but the idea is they've really been focusing on them. And if you have a look at the deep state, it's pretty incredible the amount of forward movement that's taken place just in the last week on this area. It's really incomparable to any other part of the front. It's just in huge sections that have been taken, yeah.
Peter, I wonder if a lot of what I saw in your newsletters and what we've seen in the bizarre salient in Kursk, which doesn't seem to have a military purpose, can be explained by, you know, our old rhetoric cliche, which is intended audience. I mean, it might tally with the delayed orders to evacuate that you've mentioned in many battles. I think Vuhledar was one of those, like nobody got told to get out until they all knew they were doomed. And sending people on a salient, sending people, well, keeping people in place, they don't make military sense, but perhaps they make rhetorical sense if the real core audience is a very small and elite one, partly in Ukraine, partly in NATO, and it consists of the people who dispense the money from NATO and the people who are getting the money in Ukraine. That audience would not be concerned much with the lives of the soldiers expended on these adventures, but they would be very much concerned with, you know, what the advisors, what the military advisors from NATO thought about it and how good it looked to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's clear, even at the beginning of the Kursk operation, when generally Ukrainian media was very euphoric about it all, but there was still signs that there was significant dissent within the military. I wrote about this whole issue with, there was this brigade commander, Ishkulov, head of the 80th, I'm pretty sure. He was quite a popular brigade commander, known for being, and he was in the Pokrovsk region, I'm pretty sure, somewhere in Donetsk,
yes.
I'm pretty sure the Pokrovsk region.
Pokrovsk, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he was liked by his subordinates, and he was known to sort of not just, you know, hold territory at any cost, but to prioritize the lives of his soldiers and just be an effective commander and so on. But he was sacked several days before the Pokrovsk operation, sorry, the Kursk operation, and it was quite a media event. All the different nationalist telegrams, all the different Azov telegrams, they all posted in support of him, calling on Zelensky to return him to his post and so on, getting angry at these sort of, you know, corrupt Soviet generals that are replacing him and whatnot, which is their favorite topic. But he wasn't returned. And then essentially in the statement by Deep State about why he was removed, Deep State also, you know, wanted him to be returned. They stated that he had refused to carry out some sort of important demand, but it didn't specify which, I'm sorry, some kind of operation. He wasn't, he didn't like some kind of new planned operation. Essentially, it came out after the Kursk that he was against the Kursk operation because his people ended up getting sent to the Kursk. This was also confirmed by The Guardian as well, and so Western media. That's quite it. So there was already opposition to it, right? Because they sent the most battle-ready troops. I mean, it's Zelensky and lots of sort of the nationalist media and all the liberal nationalist media in Ukraine. And there's lots of rumors that the liberal nationalist media are actually kind of working in cahoots with Zelensky. This is kind of a topic the past couple of months where the nationalists sort of make fun of the liberal nationalists who claim to be very anti-Zelensky. Anyway, but Zelensky and the liberal nationalist media, I mean like Radio Free Europe, all those kind of stuff, they often claimed no troops from Donbass were sent to Kursk apart from the 80th. But I mean, be that as it may, obviously the fact remains that wherever you sent them from, that's still valuable troops that could have been used in the in Donbass, right? Instead of in Kursk, and quite a few obviously were sent to Kursk, and they're suffering, you know, significant losses, and it's this sort of long-standing sort of war of attrition.
You also quoted some people from some elite nationalist units, and then I saw some more of that after that, who were saying we're glad we were sent to Kursk because it's much better than being basically in the Pokrovsk front, where basically we're just getting mauled by artillery and drones and you can't move and you can't do anything glorious. And of course, there are just some border guards and you get to run around, take enemy territory and be like, you know, mobile and show off. And they have all the fancy equipment. I mean, even still, they have Bradleys and Abrams and like they still get all of the sort of shiny NATO equipment there. They get priority there, it looks like. They haven't been deprioritized yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's some sort of Valhalla type sort of thing going on, which is obviously quite important for lots of them. But, you know, I mean, in terms of prioritizing, by the way, there was an interesting thing earlier this month. One of the top Azov guys, Kukharchuk, he made a Twitter post getting angry about how the Western equipment is not being given to Azov, but it's being given to these newly formed units. And this is actually, and he was angry, because the problem is that these newly formed units, Zelensky is forming all of these units, and they're often called zombie brigades. For instance, Mariana Bezugla is this kind of strange figure who, anyway, she's this big military critic and so on. But also lots of other military analysts. There's one that's really interesting to follow, Roman Ponomarenko, which is this, he's this Azov military historian, and he has been writing a lot about the decline in the quality of the officer corps in the Ukrainian army, particularly because they're just creating all these new brigades.
Why? And then they just, is this for a corruption reasons?
Yeah, there's definitely that element to it. There's definitely that element to this whole dead souls aspect. There's this constant sort of little scandals about that. That's particularly bad with these territorial defense units, which are also very have very low motivation and so on. We can talk about that a little bit later, but
sure.
It's just interesting with the officer quality problem where they're creating these new units. I mean, one, apart from the corruption aspect, there's also this, you know, you often hear these things about, you know, counter-offensive in 2025, so on, or 2026, whatever else. And I mean, honestly, I think that is something that, obviously, that they're preparing for. I mean, right, with Kursk, that was one thing. Obviously, that was using more existing units in Kursk. But I'm sure that they're preparing some new, wonderful counter-offensive. And so they're creating these new units, but with and there's already been so many losses among junior and mid-level command staff. This is from Roma Panamarenko, and just this rapid increase, and they just get new officers by advertisement. This is what he says. Many frontline commanders they're just so tired of fighting for so long, they're transferring to rear positions. And then another interesting thing is just the quality of training is very unsatisfactory.
Yes.
This is a constant theme in your recent newsletters, which are really good, and it tallies with a lot of what our personnel analysts in the audience have said. Like, you don't replace a top commander. I mean, you can maybe replace a platoon commander fairly quickly, but somebody who's commanding a larger unit takes years to train. And you don't waste them. I mean, their lives are a sort of quantity in a game, so to speak. And it's not even a matter of compassion. You just don't waste lives like that. And it's odd how Azov seems to be much more pragmatic, even though they're usually depicted as complete ideological fanatics, but they seem to be saying, no, don't waste the guys who do all the bureaucratic stuff. We need them. And meanwhile, the patriotic faction just wants to throw them into the front lines.
Well, I mean, there's this ongoing debate between, it's generally framed by Azov and the media, which always essentially supports Azov, the liberal, like, you know, Radio Free Europe and Bezugla as well, and they all sort of support. And the Azov narrative is that there are these highly motivated brigade-level commanders that are with their troops, that actually care about the war and that actually care about preserving their troops' lives, like Azov, but not only in Azov, you know, they point to other, you know, highly motivated brigade commanders and so on. And then there are the Soviet generals. This is, they always talk about how there's this Soviet corruption. This is the main thing. And who only care of the common sort of slogan, they say they only care about points on the map. You know, we have to hold this village, right? And no stepping back. And they really hate that because they say, look, we're wasting our best men and so on. We need to think about things in a more strategic manner, and also how exactly we're going to hold different positions, you know, what kind of tactics and the organizational issues and so on. And so that's generally how it's framed by them. One criticism that you can sort of make is that often, I mean, sometimes it sort of seems like the Azov guys are just saying, you know, put us in charge, everything will be fine. But I mean, I think the most interesting criticism that is made is about the actual organizational structure of the army. And this is something that I return to quite a lot in my stuff, just because, you know, they're always talking about it. I mean, there was this one really interesting statement by Butusov, who's like the top, he's this top military journalist. On topic about one thing about Butusov, which is funny, he's this huge military journalist, right? Everyone to the front, supports mobilization to the hilt. But the day that the mobilization law was passed, he renewed his medical exemption on the basis of bad eyesight.
Bad eyesight?
Even though, like, you know, he's always at the front, you know, like, crazy journalist stuff. He had this famous video in 2021 when he was behind a a grenade launcher or some big heavy artillery firing into the Donbass on Holodomor Day. And he was saying, this is for Holodomor. And he was violating the Minsk agreements because you're not meant to shoot and so on. Anyways, he's a pretty unhinged guy. He has lots of, he's very anti-Zelensky, and he's this Poroshenko kind of aligned guy. And lots of vitriol towards Zelensky, all of the top. He has about 1.5 million subscribers. He's the most popular military journalist. But he had this quite interesting thing to say, which is that the problem with our army is that we have no broader organizational structures. We're the only army in the world, he says, that fighting with only with brigades. This is what he says. Whereas our enemy is fighting with corps and all the different sort of the military terminology of the larger structures that the Russians have. Basically, there's no real coordination between our units. And you can see this in terms of what's actually unfolding at the front. The way that cities are being lost is it's generally that less well-trained or less motivated unit, often a territorial defense unit, they'll start buckling. They'll leave positions, and then the Russians will take other positions that are, even if they're manned by higher quality troops and so on. There was a very interesting. This is very
the rotations current. Are a disaster over and over, aren't they?
I'll get to the rotations in a second. That's really. Yeah. But I mean, like, for instance, there's really this about the Karnyak, which is ongoing right now in this whole Slidova Korakhova area. I'll just read this out. This is this was a couple of days ago, basically, where basically relatives of the military personnel there were sharing on social media that the 210th Separate Battalion fell into operational encirclement because the neighboring 154th Battalion abandoned its positions because it had suffered such heavy losses. And on social media, the relatives were saying that the 210th Battalion tried to break out of the encirclement and leave their positions in Karnyak, for which they received threats of execution from command.
Wow.
They were ordered to return to Karnyak, but most refused to comply because of their physical and moral exhaustion. And charges of desertion have been filed against the soldiers with the State Bureau of Investigation. But I mean, I will note as well, that's quite rare receive charges of desertion. There's, most people just desert and they get no charges filed against them at all. We'll talk about the desertion thing in a second. But with the rotations, what's interesting there is that there was an interesting post by this military telegram, a smaller one that's quite interesting to follow, called Manaheim's son. They often have names like this. Where
they love their Nazis, man.
Yeah. And he was comparing the Russian rotation system to that of Ukraine's. And he was, in particular, he was talking about how, look, whenever we read the military analysis, Western or whatever else, it's always saying, like, you know, the Russians are moving forward, but soon they're going to be exhausted, right? They're going to exhaust their forces anytime soon. Yeah. But, you know, he says, look, it's been a year of continuous Russian offensives now, and they reach a new peak of intensity every month.
It's incredible.
And they says, how does this happen? Why are predictions of its end not come true? And he takes a look at one Russian assault military unit, the 139th Separate Assault Battalion, which was, anyway, who cares where it was, but it was basically in this area of the Donbass, Vodina and whatever. And this purely assault unit fought in 2024 with the following scheme. 2 months of combat, 2 months of rotation with replenishment up to 80-90%. This is Russian unit. 2 months of combat and so on. Wow. And this applies to most Russian assault units. And in practice allows them to maintain and increase intensity through phase replacement. And rotations at the front line are relatively easy for the enemy, for the Russians, since we're entrenched in a static defense due to depleted resources and cannot hinder them. Lots of them actually, they talk about how the problem of how we, the Ukrainian side, are stuck in the static defense mode of just holding on to villages. And we need to have some kind of other approach to this, because the static defense is just... It's totally ineffective and bad for us in this situation. But anyway, and the Manaheim son says that all predictions about the end of the offensive will not be relevant because they don't take into account the number of Russian units undergoing combat readiness recovery or the enemy's ability to systematically replenish them. And he calls this that the moral of the story is that a well-structured system, even if it's a death conveyor belt, which is a cool phrase, I thought, yields results in the battlefield in the long term. Meanwhile, endless chaos on our side doesn't even allow proper preparation of a second line of defense. You constantly have this whole theme of the lack of any overarching military organization on the Ukrainian side. And I think really, I mean, when Butusov talked about how we're fighting only with brigades, with battalions, it was in the context of this round table talk at Ukrainska Pravda, which is the biggest kind of Ukrainian pro-Western media, like U.S. funded and so on. And the interlocutor, which is one of the main editors of Ukrainska Pravda, he was relating it to the corruption scandals in the Ukrainian elite that they always talk about. And the way in which in wartime you've had this huge concentration of power around Zelensky, Yermak, the head of his presidential administration, essentially those two, and Tatarov as well, this kind of stranger figure as well. Well, not stranger, but this small circle of individuals who they don't actually have, you know, any real official, like, they're not ministers, right? They don't actually have some kind of institutional position. They're head of the presidential administration, which is this very strange, the office, as it's called in Ukraine. And it's always had this weird kind of gray cardinal status in Ukraine. But it doesn't have, you know, real clearly defined institutional parameters and clearly defined responsibilities, which ends up meaning that they take control of everything. Like, they're in charge, you know, Tatarov is in charge of all law enforcement. And he determines all law enforcement in the country, right? And then Yermak is in charge of everything, basically, in the country. And they're always complaining about this, these pro-Western media, but also these military journalists, because, I mean, obviously it's not possible for one person to effectively control everything, right, in any situation, in a wartime situation as well. But I think what this represents, and I mean, they were saying this as well, is that you have kind of this structure of society which is focused around these competing clans, right? You know, like, that are competing to take control of the state apparatus and thereby, you know, increase their rent revenue, essentially. Mm-hmm. And to do so, they need to control all of the state apparatus, especially the courts, law enforcement, because that's this crucial place where you can, you know, get rid of your enemies and sort of, you know,
seize property,
property and so on. Yeah. So the court system is kind of the only institution that actually really exists. Because of its importance in these corrupt battles, essentially. But what I mean is that this societal structure is essentially it's the same in the military, where you have all these weird little generals with these strange fiefdoms and their kind of constant clan warfare. And Bezuhla writes about this as well. And they're all sort of chilling out somewhere, you know, in Edessa, way back in the, you know, some kind of villa and where, and they have a bunch of villas. And then, but they, all they care about is just, you know, hold this point in the front line because we need this for our career advancement.
Right.
And are they also, as most corrupt militaries in that situation, they're also collecting salaries for ghost soldiers?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Is that a problem?
Yeah.
Dead souls. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's a huge thing. I mean, that's also funny. I mean, this is with these territorial defense battalions, which were set up at the start of the war, and we just had ordinary people with no military training, and they played a role, often an extremely bloody role, often where they suffered obviously very high losses because they had no military training, but they wanted to fight and so on. But what's happened is that these units have this very strange institutional place in the army. It doesn't really make sense. And there's a huge number of them, it's hundreds of them, and they have no real interconnection between them. But these are often used as a refuge for dead souls as well. For instance, Shabunyan, right, who's this very famous, he's one of the main anti-corruption NGO new nobility guys who's always meeting with the US ambassador and so on, but he's been supposedly serving right for the whole time of the war, but he obviously isn't serving, but he receives an income from this territorial defense unit. Also Vakarchuk, the singer of Okean Ilse, who's like this really
John and I wrote some great stuff about him, and as John pointed out, it sounds like U2, except the whole time you're watching this U2 song, you're looking at an SS Wolf's angle. Which would actually fit.
I looked Vakarchuk up, and he's very much from an elite family, right? His parents were both physics professors.
Yeah,
he's the kind of person who became an oligarch in Yeltsin's time in Russia, right?
Yes.
And now he's a pop star, but he's not only a pop star writing patriotic militaristic songs, but he also refused to comment. If I read your newsletter right. He refused to comment after the conscription teams were grabbing people who'd attended his concert.
Yeah. Well, there's actually an incredible twist to this story, which turns out that, so he's supposedly serving in the army, Vakarchuk, right? Although obviously he isn't. He's in Canada right now on a new tour. Hopefully I get to see him. I really want to go to his concert.
The Northern Front.
He's defending Honka.
His early songs, he's got some kind of funny 90s indie songs. They're kind of fun to listen to. I listened to the latest stuff out of this sort of, I don't know, curious, ironic, I don't know. It's just kind of funny, the whole phenomenon of this guy. Anyway, but it turns out that his brother is actually serving in the army, but there's a big but. He's serving in the military conscription office.
So he gets to forcibly conscript others.
That's right. So he serves in the military conscription office in the Lviv region, which is a very lucrative position. We'll definitely talk about the corruption of that at some point if we get to it. But that's too much of a big topic to begin right now. So let's continue with the current thing. But where were we? So we're talking about
Vakarchuk and conscription.
Yeah. With territorial defense units. That's right. So these units, they're filled with ghost people who aren't actually fighting, and also they just get no training, they get no weapons, and these are responsible often for these collapses of the front line. For instance, at Vugledar, wasn't being held by a territorial defense unit; it was being held by the 72nd, which was this quite this unit that, but it fought there for like 3 years.
They were really good.
And they were incredibly exhausted. And they came back and they were promised that they would get rotations by the, it's like the 187th Brigade of the 123rd Territorial Defense Unit. But then this Territorial Defense Unit, they staged a mass mutiny, which is the first time this has been publicly covered by Ukrainian media. And they all just refused to fight because they said they'd been given no weapons at all. And there's photos of it. You know, you see these guys and they're all just these big, you know, they're just these ordinary guys, right?
Yeah.
And it's clear that they are not really prepared for war at all. Some of them are very overweight and some of them are just very skinny and they're all very quite old. And so they refused to fight. So the 72nd had to continue fighting. And then the commander of this territorial defense unit committed suicide right after that, because of the mutiny of his troops. Although it's unclear how he actually died. I mean, but anyway, I mean, the most people are assuming it was suicide. And that's a really common situation. And there's lots of people calling for the disbandment of these territorial defense units and so on. But it's this broader structure. Butusov says that we don't have any larger organs responsible for the army at tactical and strategic levels. We only have improvised temporary organs, and they don't carry responsibility for the troops under them or military results. Their only purpose is to look at the map and move pins around it, representing troops.
This is so interesting, your description of all this, because first of all, in a lot of ways, it reminds me of Yeltsin-era Russia. I mean, your description of the centralized power, the clannishness centralized around like a couple of people. Although, you know, Yeltsin was obviously half alive. Zelensky's more alive, but Zelensky, I mean, it's such a weird thing. This country is run by two entertainers. An entertainer and an entertainment. Yeah, an entertainer. And then Yermak is an entertainment lawyer or entertainment producer?
Even worse, I think. Yeah,
he's a producer. Well, yeah.
A lawyer is even worse than an entertainer. But yeah, he was was a lawyer, uh-huh. But he was specifically entertainment, production and so on. Yeah, that's right. And then Tatarov is a bit different because he's actually got nothing to do with Zelensky and so on. Tatarov is a really... one of these classic Ukrainian figures that survived everything. He used to work for Yanukovych. He had basically the same position under Yanukovych, where he was this guy in charge of the court system who was just incredibly important and kind of weird and creepy, but no one can do anything about him because he's just has this incredibly important asset under his control. But lots of the liberal national, like the liberals, they really hate him because he was supposedly in charge of different law enforcement groups during Maidan that repressed different Maidan protesters. They always bring this up. But there are lots of kind of interesting conspiracy theories that actually the liberal nationalists, they're all under Tatarov because Tatarov is able to control whether they get mobilized or not. And the fact that they don't get mobilized, several different Ukrainian media have been writing about this, which shows that, and that the reason that they constantly never shut up about Tatarov is because they're trying to, it's like a red herring to distract from the fact that they're actually totally under him. Anyway, that's a funny whole thing going on. But anyway, so Yermak is a lawyer, basically. Yeah.
So this is kind of a left field question, but it's stimulated by something that was announced recently and boosted by the media in the Anglophone world. Russia has accepted the offer of, I think, 3,000 North Korean military personnel, which should help to relieve the personnel pressure on the Russian army in Ukraine. Now, if the Ukrainians have, as they clearly do, a kind of open account with NATO, and if NATO has a lot of money, which it clearly does, has there been any talk about offering money to mercenaries from warlike but impoverished countries?
For Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, that's been going on throughout the whole war. I mean, there are Colombians, Peruvians, Brazilians, Syrians, Yemenis. I mean, I have friends in Ukraine relatively small towns very far from the front line. And they often will see these Arabs just back from the front line or the Colombians and so on. And you'll often see this in the news, Colombians getting killed. Yeah. I know Colombians just randomly from my life, and they see it on TikTok and so on. And these are generally, you know, Colombians that worked for different, you know, security companies in Colombia. Obviously, their enemies in Colombia were quite different to the one they're facing in Ukraine. They were generally, you know, I don't know, going after some farmers or whatnot, or, you know, doing battle with different drug groups. But now they're in a totally different war. Well, that's right. Well, I mean, between, that's what I meant. Now it's a totally different war. And they're often different story. Sometimes there've been a couple, several times throughout the war I've seen where they have fights with the Ukrainians because they feel like they're being disregarded and cast out to die. And they'll get to real physical fights and so on. And often you'll hear, you know, some news of that they got hit and they got killed, and the Ukrainian military doesn't say anything about it. The relatives only find out through, through just strange different other means. Anyway, so that's been ongoing throughout the war. They're not that effective just because they don't really, none of the, you know, you don't get this training. This is the whole thing. I mean, this is what I was talking about, this whole organizational aspect. That's how wars are won, when you have this huge military organism that works together. Butusov has lots of praise for the Russian military organization.
Yeah, that is so interesting to me because the Ukrainians for the first year of the war did nothing but laugh at the Russians.
Yeah. And now it's the opposite.
And I've been seeing that through your newsletters and on social media for a while now.
Because he talks about how the Ukrainian military is irresponsible and the head command don't care about the so detached from the people on the ground. But then he says our enemy's army is far more organized, partly because of a different organizational structure. They have divisions, corps, and armies. Each structure has people directly responsible. But our Ukrainian army is unique among all armies in the past century that we have tactical level organs, but no operational ones. We're the only army in world history without divisions or corps on the front, only brigades. And these brigades are essentially just strengthened regiments. Meanwhile, our enemy is fighting with divisions.
Is that related to the personnel shortage? Because it sort of reminds me of the Confederate Army in the late years of the Civil War. They had a lot of hollow units.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's these zombie units, you know, where they're creating these new units and they're staffed with unmotivated people. And you have these crazy statistics that I've been writing about recently where, the amount of mobilized people that are actually willing to fight, it's just minuscule. I mean, there was one, I think it was Igor Masychuk, which is this big Ukrainian politician.
Oh, that guy, yeah.
And he was, he used to be a soldier, whatever, that guy. But he was saying how 1 out of 25 mobilized people actually was able to fight, and the rest, they all just refused to fight. This is in some location he has personal experience.
But as crazy as that sounds, that is not too far off from even like CNN articles and some other talking about Ukrainian commanders complaining that everybody they send out who's a new recruit deserts.
And you've reported,
I mean, even mainstream publications have reported that there's up to 80,000 desertions in Ukrainian army, but you've reported up to 200,000 desertions this year, which is an insane number.
Yeah, well, because the number of registered desertions, legally registered, is 86,000. But the thing is, these are the only, and then out of them, only 5,000 of them have actually been charged. So there's this whole problem where none of the people, and then there have been all these laws passed recently, which have actually weakened the punishment for desertion.
Right. It's like in lieu of doing any rotating, because they can't. Because they can't come up with a structure, as Butusov said, where you just rotate and get rid of the chaos. Yeah. It's like, well, we just won't charge them for desertion.
But that's so strange. Because like in the late years of World War I, in the late years of the U.S. Civil War, when there's a severe personnel problem for an elite autocratic regime, they generally introduce the death penalty in a big way.
Well, this has not been happening. It's definitely the opposite. We definitely should talk about desertion in more detail, but just coming back to the North Korea question, look, there have been so many different estimates for the numbers. I mean, the Ukrainians keep on coming out because it's mainly the Ukrainians and the South Koreans, but they also have different. I mean, I think it was the South Koreans that started talking about this, and the Ukrainians picked up on this. But even they have quite different estimates. The Ukrainians right now, they've reached up to 12,000, something like this. Mm-hmm. I think that was Budanov's last prediction. Budanov is well known as an incredibly reliable source.
Yeah.
This
is the head of military intelligence, Kirill Budanov.
This very, very, very strange figure writing about a lot recently, actually, as well. But anyway, that's an whole other topic. But then the Americans at first refused to confirm. And then eventually they have confirmed. Now they're saying 3,000, which is obviously a big difference. But in any case, I mean, look, as the Ukrainian military telegrams themselves say, the Russians are not suffering from personnel shortages, right? Like they are doing very well in terms of personnel at the front. And this is also linked with the salaries as well. I mean, there was an interesting post by one Ukrainian military telegram that I quite like, Tales of the Fourth Reich, who I have some interesting inside scoop on who this guy is. And he was apparently, he actually used to be an anti-fascist football hooligan. But in 2014...
Even Ukrainian anti-fascists are...
That's right. Well, this was a big phenomenon. Yeah. This was a big phenomenon where they were pro-Maidan because they hated like Yanukovych because he's this big, you know, corrupt Russian, blah, blah, non-civilized and so on. And then they joined Maidan and they hung out a lot with the right sector and they're like, oh, these guys are pretty cool. They throw Molotov cocktails at the police. Yep. So they're basically anarchists just like us. Yeah. And then they joined the war in 2014. And then you started seeing these interviews with them, like with this guy, for instance, when he still considered himself an anti-fascist. And he said, well, I'm still an anti-fascist, but I think we should also kill everyone in Southeast Ukraine. And he says these things. And he says, look, I think Mussolini had some interesting ideas as well. And he says, but then he just transformed. And this guy is most likely this sergeant in Azov called Akula Shark. Anyway, he has this very interesting telegram, which I really enjoy following, called Tales of the Fourth Reich. It's now been changed to Tales of the Fourth Empire, but whatever. I prefer the old name. I think it's cooler. Yes. And he's still very open about loving Hitler and so on. So I just call it the old name. What's interesting about him, he's also quite pro-ceasefire. He thinks that the war is being continued forever by the, you know, LGBT US Democrats. He's like a Trump guy. and by these like liberal NGO people that he detests as well inside of Ukraine, and by the Zelensky government, which he also thinks is basically expending all the nationalists to get rid of its political opposition. But he has this interesting post about salaries, which is that in Russia, a soldier receives $9,000 from the president for signing the first contract, and then the president also obliges governors to contribute additional funds. And the smallest amount for signing the first contract is in the Orenburg region, $11,000. But in other regions, the figure is much higher. I mean, in Moscow, I forgot what the figure is, but it's like a huge figure. If you sign up in Moscow, you get like, I mean, $20,000. It might even be like $100,000. It's a really enormous amount of money.
What do Ukrainian soldiers get?
But then in Ukrainian soldiers, a soldier receives between $500 and $700.
Jesus.
And he says, if we were, and then he's really angry about how the idea of the servants of the people, Zelensky's party, is to steal as much money as possible and then flee abroad as soon as the Russians appear and so on and so on. But he's really angry about how the Zelensky, he always talks about how Ukrainian soldiers are fighting for freedom. So the salaries don't matter so much. This is a kind of comment. And he says, if we were hearing similar statements from Hamas leaders, it would make sense. Ideological fanatics ready to die fighting for their beliefs. there was another interesting thing by Roman Ponomarenko on the same topic. This is the Azov military historian. Saying that members of parliament from Seven of the People can continue to comfort themselves with the illusion that Ukrainians are truly ready to fight for their land, for their ideology, for the right to live freely as free people. Unfortunately, this wonderful formula lacks the key trait of a free person, responsibility, which our society is sorely lacking. The sad truth is that for the most part, Ukrainians do not want to fight, and military service is extremely unpopular. There's no point in forcibly mobilizing such people in a time crunch. Anyway, but I mean, it's quite a funny contrast with the way that the sort of Western media portrays the whole situation. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Everyone's just itching to fight. But
everything is the opposite. I mean, also what you talked about, what you've been talking about, which is the chaos, which is now considered, among Ukrainians a major problem. The lack of centralization, the lack of organization. These were held up as democratic values in 2022, as these were like glorified in the Western media, proving that Ukrainians, the reason they're winning over authoritarian, top-down, don't think for themselves Russians is because they were decentralized. Now, and that could be true in a guerrilla war, but in a World War One style trench war, it's really bad, you know, when you can't even hook up two trench works together. And and it turns out that it's just, I think you brought it back to kind of Ukrainian history and culture and like the period of 1917 to 1920. I mean, this trend runs pretty deep in Ukrainian culture and history. And it's a real problem. But getting back to recruitment, you talked about another thing, which just I found really shocking as well, which is, so of course, you know, Zelensky passed this mobilization law under heavy pressure from the Americans in return for getting that $60 billion military aid package. So they were going to do mass mobilization and lower the age from 27 to 25. And at first, mobilization numbers went up a lot. Now, it turns out a lot of them just don't want to fight. But the number, they were recruiting something like 35,000 a month, which is actually more than the Russians have been doing. The Russians are about 30 estimated, let's say. And it's already dropped to like from 35,000 to 20,000. So it's already dropped almost in half in just like 4 or 5 months. And that, I guess, is why they're now saying we got to drop it to 18, even though there aren't a whole lot of 18 to 25-year-olds as it is, right?
Yeah, look, I mean, one last thing about the Korean thing. I do think that since Russia's not suffering from personnel shortages, I who even knows what's actually happening with the Koreans? If there are any Koreans in Russia, who knows? If there are, I think it's also part. I mean, one rumor that's been going around is that they'll be used to construct tunnel systems and trench fortifications as sort of more rear guard work. But as is, you know, well known, North Korea is has the most advanced tunnel systems in the world. And they've actually, I mean, DPRK troops have traveled across the world training other, well, I guess, you know, anti-Western forces in the construction of tunnels. They trained Hezbollah, and Hezbollah transferred this to Hamas. And it was Korean advisors that were actually helping Hezbollah construct their tunnels in the 2000s. This was a really important factor. And there's one interesting thing. I mean, this is from Electronic Intifada, actually, which is that apparently there's some kind of U.S. Marine Corps that's been training to storm the Korean tunnels for like 60 years now. And each one of their simulations just fails. Total casualty.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Anyway, wow. The tunnels have played a role. I think it was in Taryetsk that there was some kind of Russian sapper or something that dug a tunnel under and was able to actually take more territory because of this.
Yeah.
So look, I think that's possible. In terms of some, you know, because the way the Western media is portraying it, Avdiivka, is portraying it, you know, there's going to be some kind of mass Mongol, you know, offensive, and there's going to be millions of these, you know, these Asians just pouring across the front. I think that seems really unlikely. Also, just because, you know, there's the language barriers as well. Yeah. And just the whole thing about, I mean, the Russian army has this quite defined organizational structure, and I don't know why they just toss in maybe, who knows? But it seems more likely they would be doing other things, especially when the number is quite small. I mean, 3,000 is nothing really. Like even 12,000 isn't, I mean, maybe at one specific point in the map. I don't know. It seems more likely anything else. It could be, who knows? But anyway, but back to the...
I'm sorry, before we finish North Korea, I have a quick theory I wanted to put out there. Because at first I was skeptical because even NATO and the, you know, DOD were saying, no, we have no evidence of this. And they kept saying that up until they flipped on a dime and said, yep, now we do have evidence. And it seems that, and then literally a day after that, yesterday, Putin, I don't know if you saw his answer at that press conference, somebody asked him about it. And it almost seemed like a question that he wanted asked or planted or something, because he was very proud answering. He said something like, wow, satellite data shows that North Korean troops are here. Isn't that interesting? Satellite data is very interesting. Like, and then he said, well, if something like that were to happen, I should let you know that, you know, we did sign, and literally, I think it was just yesterday, the Duma pushed through this defense pact with North Korea that had been talked about and that had been constantly sort of downplayed. I started looking back at it in the Western and American press. But basically, they signed a defense pact, and Putin pointed to Article 4 of this defense pact. And it's basically like a NATO treaty between Russia and North Korea, where if one country's territory is attacked, the other country will provide military aid to help it come to its defense. And technically, when Ukraine invaded Kursk, technically, according to the treaty, that means Russia was invaded and North Korea is coming to its defense. And it's more like, but the way I am reading it, because they didn't just do it on the fly, they're rolling this out, is Putin is letting the world and really the West know that this war has consequences for you too, because now this means that Russia has pledged to defend Korea if Korea is attacked. And we're always talking about attacking Korea, you know. I know they have nukes, but like Russia now, basically Russia is providing its nuclear and military umbrella to North Korea. And while I think for the Americans, this is, for Washington, this is a big ego issue. Treaties are the big ego. It's like Biden, he still is so proud that he NATO-ized Finland. And the only thing that would make him angry is if the other side Russia-ized or Warsaw Pact-ized some other country. That's a loss. NATO-ized, that's a win. You know, Warsaw Pact-ized, that's a loss. So that's an ego loss for Washington, maybe a loss in other ways. But I think for South Korea and Japan, that's kind of a threat as well. That's not what you want. You want North Korea isolated, and you want options, and that's kind of taken away options. So I don't know. I'm seeing it more like a rollout of these are the some of the consequences of your support for Ukraine.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I just it brings back to mind how when there was the Kursk operation, there were, you know, people were making fun of how you know, Russia's red lines mean nothing, and so on and so on. Because they haven't, I don't know, like nuked Washington in response. But there was more interesting, I mean, listening to, you know, Russian sort of serious foreign policy analysis. I mean, I think it was Fyodor Lukyanov, who's this very important Russian international relations analyst and so on. Valdai Club and so on. And also, I mean, I think this was Putin's statements as well, which is that, you know, our response is going to involve assisting more anti-Western groups around the world. And that's something which is more unpredictable. Actually, also the Medusa guy was talking about this as well. Because I also listened to him quite a bit.
He's good.
And sometimes he's sort of, anyway. But he was talking about this as well, about how it's hard really to understand Russia's response, because this is going to be something that will be known by U.S. Intelligence community, but it won't be trumpeted necessarily throughout the world. But they're going to know that, you know, this, you know, group has received this weaponry and so on. And I think with this is, you know, with Korea, this is a huge statement as well, which is that, look, you know, this was this red line. Don't cooperate with North Korea. You're not meant to. They're the bad guys, and Russia's doing the opposite. And it's really, and with this move, it's even if they're only just training them in Russia, that's still a huge sort of, you know, fuck you to the Americans. It's like, no, like we're going to train your worst enemies, and there's nothing you can do about it. And we might even use them against your friends. And so
I mean, the Russians used to be, up until, I don't know, 2014 at least, team players with America. I mean, even Putin was, because North Korea kind of, the possibility of chaos kind of freaked them out. And they wanted to be part of sort of diplomatic solutions. So it's quite a reversal, man. It's quite something. Let's talk about another big story that you've done some great newsletters on, which is Zelensky's victory plan. What is the victory plan and where is it right now?
Yeah, the victory plan. Yeah, so I mean, there was some, it was really weird watching the coverage of it, because it was this big event in the RADA, right? And there was someone, because I was listening to the Radio Free Europe, Ukrainian version. They're actually quite fun to listen to, honestly. They have this presenter. This is a really weird name. It's like Varla Bara or something. I don't know. I forgot it. It's a very strange name.
You're talking about the Ukrainian version of Radio Free
Europe? That's right.
Yeah, which is like Nazi infested even up to this day. It's so funny, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, look, I mean, look, they're all totally unhinged. But yeah. What I mean is, it's just like the presenter. She just goes really hard on the guests, and she asks them really intense, uncomfortable questions because she has these, you know, these idiotic, you know, all these different seven of the people, government officials, and just some, you know, these different soldiers. You know, she had this soldier on recently. And he was like, yeah, we're at the front. We're killing 50 Russians for each one we lose, but it's difficult, you know. And she was asking him, so why exactly are you retreating? Like, keeps on asking him these questions. She's this sort of prim sits there. Anyway, I kind of
good
like
for
it.
Her. Yeah.
And she asked these uncomfortable questions to the seven of the people that were coming in about the servants of the people, I suppose.
Servants of the people in Zelensky's party, we should remind.
That's right. Yeah. So she was asking them these questions about the victory plan, and they were this, and she ended up, the person she was asking, who's this servant of the people, ended up just saying, look, we need to trust the president. If you don't trust the president, you're ruining internal cohesion. We must trust the president. And she kind of repeating this. And she's like, I know that you, as one of the conscious journalists, want us to win. So why are you not trusting the president?
Man, that's bad.
And I mean, there was, I think they also counted the amount, there was a huge amount, there was constant applause as well. It was very, you know, like people always talk about this, you know, 1930s, you know, Soviet speeches. But it was like this, where it was every, another mention of NATO and everyone just claps, you know, constant clapping. And then, and there were all these silly things. I mean, the guy in the Stefanchuk, who's the speaker of the RADA, this guy's you know, often in photo shoots with Zelensky and so on. He was talking with journalists, and they were asking him, you know, how big is this victory plan? And he was very coy, and he was kind of laughing. He was like, well, it's actually, I'll tell you the secret. It's 12 pages, binders. I don't know, just like very, very childish. And it's just very, very hard to take seriously because, I mean, damn, you know, I mean,
yeah, because they were keeping it secret for a while.
Serious problems taking place, keeping it secret. Right? There's still some secret points that are not to be discussed, that we cannot, that are only for the partners and so on. And I mean, and the obvious response from the Ukrainian, you know, nationalist opposition people and so on, and all these, you know, Putusov, all these different guys, these Poroshenko style people, is they're saying, look, we agree that we want to be in NATO. That's great. But this is not a plan. A plan would involve some kind of concrete steps for how we're going to reform the army, what we're going to do to not lose the war. But it doesn't have any of that. The plan is just, let us join NATO.
Yes.
We have lots of minerals. So you should let us into NATO. Give us more weapons.
Does the plan involve getting Crimea back, or would it be enough, according to the
nothing,
plan, just
there's
to
not
get
even
the,
anything
the
about
Eastern stuff back.
It doesn't talk about that in the plan. You can access the plan. If you look up Zelensky's victory plan, you can see it's on BBC and so on, the Western. It's very boring. It just says, please let us join NATO. That's the first thing. You must let us join NATO. Lots of it's been interpreted as being this thing where Zelensky asked to get let into NATO, and he's not going to get let in. And this is his way of preparing Ukrainian society for freezing the conflict. I honestly think that's bullshit.
Oh my God! And the Western reaction, as I look this up, why the West should embrace Zelensky's victory plan for Ukraine? Zelensky's victory plan for Ukraine makes sense.
But honestly, I mean, I don't know. The Western response has been fairly lukewarm. I mean, the CNN's like,
for most of it,
Zelensky
been,
unveils his victory plan after failing to drum up additional support from allies. And the NATO, Mark Rutter, the head of NATO or whatever, who actually, he had a street named after him in Ukraine recently. Mark Rutter Street. Fantastic. But anyway, incredibly uncharismatic person, but whatever. And he stated Dutch. That we... Dutch, yeah, well, yeah. No surprise. And but it's like the origins of the Democratic Revolution, right? It's the, what's it with that stupid thing back in the... whatever. But... he stated where it's like, well, we at NATO, we can't fully get on board with Zelensky's victory plan because the whole point is that you need to let us into NATO.
The point of the plan is you, NATO, are going to fight our war with us. That's it. You'll go to war against Russia. That's the plan. And, yeah. And then of course you'll also give us a whole bunch of your weapons, as we empty your stores. And someday we'll sell you this incredibly, awesome tons of minerals and oil wealth. This is the Kuwait of Europe here, waiting to be exploited. And I don't blame them for it, but NATO's like, we're not going to fight your war. And it's funny. I mean, I've seen people trying to come up with a patriotic Ukrainians that I follow trying to come up with some kind of reasonable victory plan, including that account to Tatagami, I think is what it's called. You may know what I'm talking about. And he's like, look, one thing I like about that account is that a long time ago, he started trying to tell the other sort of patriotic nationalist types, stop pretending like the Russians are a bunch of dumb apes. They're actually good at this, and the sooner we accept that, the sooner we'll be able to actually deal with what's really going on. Like, it's you're being idiots by constantly repeating that to yourselves. And he's been trying to, dose of reality sort of stuff to Ukrainians. But then his victory plan, it was 10 points in this thread. And parts of it made some sense. We need to have the West help us set up our own localized defense industry to be able to make our own missiles so we don't need to beg them to do long-range missiles, blah, blah, whatever. But then towards the end it says, and then, of course, to make any of this happen, we need security guarantees, at least from the U.S. In other words, we need the U.S. to come in and fight the war with us. So it's like there is no way around that. Going back to the Confederacy, it's like, unless you can get the Brits to come in and fight for the Confederacy, there's no way, nothing else works. So where is the victory plan now? I mean, so it didn't catch on fire in the West so much. It basically got rejected. But what you're saying, if I understand you right, is that you're skeptical of this notion that I've bought into in the past because it didn't make sense otherwise, that Zelensky was basically setting up for, okay, the West betrayed us, Biden betrayed us. That's all I see everywhere among the pro-Ukraine crowd is Biden is Neville Chamberlain, which is just amazing. And so now we have to have some kind of bad piece that I didn't prepare you for. And it's not my fault. It's the West's fault. But you don't think that's everything that's going on there?
I don't know. I think it's possible. It's just that, Zelensky is asked to join NATO already a million times.
Yes.
Right? And I don't really, and he's done it in a very pompous manner in the past as well, with the same lack of response. I don't really think, I think that, it's possible that he wants, I've heard that he wants to get at least the invitation to NATO. This would be this big victory that would allow him to sort of say that, things are going, it's fine. Look, I honestly have very little belief in different ideas that the war is coming to an end soon. I've just seen so many of these over the whole period. And even before the war, I also thought, oh, the Minsk agreements, the U.S. will force Ukraine to implement the Minsk agreements, right? This was a thing that Ukrainian, right before the war, Ukrainian nationalists were really paranoid that, oh my God, the U.S. is going to force Ukraine to implement the Minsk agreements, and because they want to come to agreement with Russia, the U.S. and Russia. And that didn't happen. And I honestly think this war is going to continue on forever and ever and ever. That's what most Western leaders say. And I think they have, it's not that difficult for it to do that. And I think that's why I'm not, with the victory plans and stuff, I think the real determining factor really is on the front line. That's what's going to change things, not these different diplomatic things. They've already tried it so many times, and it always just fails. I think Zelensky has huge incentives for the war not to end because he's made so many enemies inside of Ukraine, especially in the economic elite. You know, he put Kolomoisky in jail, the oligarch that brought him to power. Kolomoisky's business associate, Gennady Bogolyubov, he escaped Ukraine recently, and he stated that Zelensky, the government, demanded a $100 million bribe to avoid going to jail. And this is like commonplace for all the top business elite. And so, I mean, they all hate him. And if there's going to be any peace, any minimal democracy, they're going to destroy him. They're going to totally annihilate him, right? He'd be lucky to be alive. So there's that aspect. And also, I mean, you know, I mean, people often talk about the whole nationalist coup against Zelensky. Honestly, lots of the nationalists I follow, they kind of want some sort of ceasefire. That's what I see. And they blame Zelensky and the liberal nationalists for continuing it. But I think as well, the U.S. factor, I think the U.S. is happy for it to continue, honestly. Mm. I think, you know, and they see it as getting a pretty good deal. And, you know, I think for all intents and purposes, it is their best option at the moment. Obviously, it's not a very long-term good option, but they don't really have any other options in terms of, preserving U.S. dominance in the world and so on. They are preventing, at least temporarily, Europe from allying with Russia, with this whole sort of, you know, heartland, preventing the heartland from uniting, whatever, which is what they always go on about, preventing this kind of Eurasian unity. And they have managed to, you know, cut off Germany from the Russian energy and so on. And so, and the, you know, the, who, if, are they weakening Russia? Not really, but I mean, I think this is the only option they have. They were seeing something taking, you know, taking shape that really scared them. And they don't really have any better options. So I think they'll continue as long as they can.
As Mark and I have observed many times, the wing of the Democratic Party that pushed Biden and Kamala has great power 20th century obsessions. And they look back to that time, unlike the rest of us, as a sort of golden age. And so for their purposes, just interfering with countries and playing some risk game that makes them feel intelligent, especially against the traditional enemy, Russia, which they always preferred as an enemy to the time when it seemed to offer itself as an ally, that just weirded them out. They just like doing that, it makes them feel big.
It's a consumer luxury good for that class of the highest order.
One other thing is, you know, because when you people, I think there's this false impression that, you know, the Western media is always talking about peace and so on. I mean, it's not, they're proposing these things, which are very stupid. I mean, they're saying, look, we need to, Ukraine, the remains of Ukraine will join NATO, and in return, Russia will accept a ceasefire on the front line, which is just crazy. I mean, like, the war is because of NATO. Yes. This is Russia's motivation. Why would he accept Ukraine joining NATO? It's not in NATO at the moment, right? So he's winning, and he's going to accept the opposite of what he wants. Like, that doesn't make any sense, right? I think often these, you know, I think there's electoral purposes. So they're saying, well, Biden's going to come to an agreement soon. The Democrats are going to find the peace agreement soon. Democrat U.S. elections. And I don't know. I think it's totally ridiculous. I think often there are some theories that I've seen in Ukrainian media that whenever you start seeing lots of media talk about peace, get ready for some kind of new offensive, some kind of Kursk or whatever else. And I think that's totally likely.
Yeah, well, I think there's something that you could observe as a parallel between the U.S. polity and the Ukrainian polity at this time. There's a deep detachment of the elite from the base. I mean, you've talked about this in many of your newsletters. And in the U.S., there's something very similar. Like, the New York Times crowd is very angry that Biden's wars in Ukraine and in Gaza have not inspired unity, unanimity, and enthusiasm. That's what they think they're supposed to do. And in Ukraine, there seems to be a similar kind of self-righteous anger in the elite, which is actually making money off this and has in some cases dreamed of it for decades, that the plebs are not very enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, but what would you say, last thing, I guess, on that, along with what John said, about morale? I mean, we talked about desertion rates. We've talked about, you know, as low as 1 in 25 recruits motivated to actually fight. But there still seems to be maybe a long way between that and actual kind of total morale collapse. Like, it's a far more unpredictable thing. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, one thing also to remember is that the fighting at the front line, it often involves fairly few human individuals, because there's quite a lot of, I mean, the Russians have a tactic of very small groups, right, 2 to 3 individuals. And then on the defensive side, you know, I mean, obviously there's the drone aspect, although that's becoming less effective according to military telegrams, because of different Russian countering means. But anyway, but I mean, so anyway, that's a whole, the whole numbers, it depends, and it's hard to gauge.
Right,
but right now, like, there's definitely...
It's not like zillions of people pouring out of trenches in the World War One style. It's more like a unit on a motorcycle and a couple other guys on dune buggies going after some corner of a trench. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, like Vuhledar was being held. It was like, you know, it was like 100 people or something, or even less. I don't know the amount of people in the 72nd. It was very, 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 quite a small number of people, and that's quite a large city. But in terms of mobilization, so I mean, when the mobilization law was passed, right, in April, May, and then the deadline was by July 15th. What actually happened was that the mobilization, so 6 million people didn't turn up. They were meant to turn up, but they didn't. 4 million did enter their details, right? But the problem is that of these 4 million, most of them had exemptions for various medical purposes, whatnot else. Which meant that the mobilization law itself was not very effective. But what did result in an increase in immobilized individuals was a decrease in the health standards, where you had all these, you know, reductions where, you know, if you have HIV, that's fine, and so on, this other, the tuberculosis, which obviously is also not good for morale. But then what's happened recently, I mean, Zelensky, in his sort of inimitable manner, he's decided that it's time to cancel all exemptions from mobilization, because he found out, a week ago, that there are 1.5 million people hiding from mobilization because they have exemptions, because they work in critically important factories, this is for economic, there are so many different corruption markets as well, in terms of, there's the corruption market of jobs, where you pay a critically important factory to employ you, so you pay them to be an employee, because
it gives you an exemption. That is
amazing. It gives you an exemption. Yeah. Wow. And then there's also this huge, the past week there's just been endless corruption scandals, huge ones in terms of the military doctor. I mean, this is a whole other topic. We probably don't have time to talk about this, but it's just, there's this, and they have, you know, millions of dollars, these military doctors that, and they get, and the bribes now have been reaching tens of thousands of dollars to evade mobilization from these doctors. One parliamentarian said $37,000 US dollars to get a medical white bill. It's huge money. And there's that market, and there's the market of the actual mobilization officers, which is another huge racket. Well, they'll come back every month to ask for more extortion as well if you get out. And so at every level, there's all these different corruption markets for that. But the problem is that this increase in mobilization numbers, because of reduced medical requirements, it decreased a couple of months ago. It had a short effect, but then it stopped working. In September, in September there was a sharp decline. Strana, which is the Ukrainian media publication, they talk about a 70% failure of mobilization plans this past month and a half, 2 months. So there's been this huge uptick in mobilization. But, you know, I mean, obviously it's resulting in these people that are incredibly unmotivated to fight. And lots of them don't even get to the front because of these corruption processes, where at every point if you have the money, you're able to buy your way out, right?
Right.
Apparently,
right, so the people who don't have any money are the ones who are sent to the very front line. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Apparently, the bribes for positions in the military doctor's office have reached $100,000 to be the head of an inter-district MSEC. And every single day, there's just this past week, there's basically five separate huge, and also this huge, huge scandals. Also this big scandal of all of the prosecutors in Ukraine, they're all disabled, but like they're not actually disabled, but they, this has been this huge thing where, because basically, well, I mean, it does, people are painting it as a way to evade mobilization, but most of them are actually exempt from mobilization anyway, because they're judges, they're prosecutors. Yeah. But really, they receive a pension. So they had these disabilities before the war. And this is a huge thing where they just get these, in addition to their salary, they get a pension. This is a huge thing as well. But so there's this people end up at the front line. They're poor, they're unmotivated. I really enjoyed this thing that I translated a while ago by this journalist at the front line, and he talked about how he is this kind of, you know, nationally conscious journalist and so on, but he was very depressed talking to his the other soldiers in the unit he was mobilized to, and they're all from rural, you know, West Ukraine, Central Ukraine, and all they ever talk about is corruption. Zelensky's wife has a Ferrari. It's this kind of funny sort of, you know, whatever. And he was talking to them. He's like, why aren't you patriotic? You know, Russia's going to take our country, blah, blah, blah. And they were saying, look, this guy told him, the government has only ever given me a Kalashnikov in all of my life, nothing else. Why should I fight for that? You know, like, I think that was a very, very eloquent way to put it, really. They received nothing.
Because that's just going to, that won't allow you to save yourself. It'll just get you killed.
Yeah.
I mean, often they don't even get the guns as well. And that's another thing. That's why you had these big mutinies as well, in the 123rd, which was quite recently. And so I think like what's happening now really is that the generation of fighters that were often sort of middle class, nationally motivated, nationalist and so on, lots of them became volunteers at the start of the war, right?
Yes.
And they've been fighting, but they've been fighting nonstop for years now, and they're incredibly exhausted. They get no rotations.
Well, a lot of them, I would think, are dead.
Yeah.
A lot of them are dead as well, exactly. Yeah. A lot of them are dead. Amputees. You see lots as well who are fighting, who are fighting even with a prosthetic arm. I saw about the death of one guy yesterday, this nationalist guy, and the photo of him before he died, before he went back to the front, he had a prosthetic arm already, right? So, and this is a big thing. There was this medic for this well-known nationalist battalion, the Da Vinci Wolves Battalion.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And she was complaining about how when her fighters get sent back to hospitals in the rear, the hospitals don't care at all, and they send them back to the front on crutches, right? So anyway, it's not really a generation, but this group of society that was willing to fight in the war, right? It's running out, and now the replacement is this majority of the population, which never really wanted to fight. They would go along with the slogans and so on because otherwise you're going to get some negative consequences. But in terms of actually fighting and dying, you know, they're not doing that. They'd really rather not. That's why you had this huge desertion epidemic. Because as I was saying, so like the official number of desertions is 90,000. But the fact, since they're so rarely reported, like Volodymyr Boyko, this military this journalist who actually serves in the front line, he talks about how in his unit there have been 60 desertions, but only one of them was actually reported. So he estimates desertion levels of 170,000, but he thinks it's getting closer to 200,000. And these just people just want, it's also a strange situation because these people just wandering around. There's no real there's no real punishment for them. Lots of them are armed as well. There have been several interesting situations of different like smuggling involving them and different criminal, obviously, because these are armed, angry individuals.
Got to say the parallels to the Confederacy in 1864 and 1865. Are extraordinary here. Armed deserter groups, Jefferson Davis, obsessed with pushing his own War Department clerks into uniform just to make up the shortfalls in personnel. Really extraordinary.
It's grim, man. I knew it was gonna be a grim episode, but talking through this, it's fucking sad. You know, yeah. I mean, these are like, you know, obviously you're part Ukrainian, and I spent time with these people. Like, it drives me crazy, this war. I hate this fucking war. These are all, I mean, almost all of them, aside from the Nazis, they're just regular dudes, you know, getting just slaughtered like this. I can't ever get over the George Packers and Ann Applebaums and all these Acela Corridor elites cheering them on, gleefully pushing them into the war for democracy, really for their own egos. It's just, the whole thing just disgusts me so intensely. It's just really sad. I think we stop it here. I mean, honestly, we could go on for another hour, but yeah, we got to stop it
it's
here.
It's very interesting
it
in all these
so
ways.
Interesting, and it's just... Yeah. It's great to have you on again, Peter. I know our listeners really appreciate you coming on as well, talking to us about the shit show that is the Ukraine war on the Ukraine side. Ukraine as it is told by Ukrainians. So thanks again to Peter Karataev from Events in Ukraine for joining us. And talk to you soon. Bye, John. Bye, okay. Everyone.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye.